Many people have a desire to enter the world of investing, whether it be through real estate, stocks, or entrepreneurship. However, people often face self-doubt, a limited belief system, or simply a lack of knowledge to put behind their ambition. It's easier than you think to overcome these obstacles if you know exactly what's holding you back. Partner with Andre to forge new neurological pathways that unlock breakthrough strategies for income generation, reshape your belief systems, and construct your desired life. With over 15 years of experience in finance and a decade devoted to teaching wealth preservation, these achievements are no mere coincidence. One thing is clear, if others have done it, you can too. Start your complimentary action plan today at www.andrestewartauthor.com. Welcome to the Investing Uncensored podcast. If you've been searching for ways to break free from the 9-to-5 grind, scale or start your own business, generate passive income, or gain insights from others who have achieved their desired lifestyle, get ready. Prepare to be inspired as we provide you with invaluable tips, resources, and firsthand experiences from Andre and other industry experts who have accomplished remarkable things in their respective fields. This is the Investing Uncensored podcast, your roadmap to success. And now here's your host, Andre Stewart.
Welcome to Investing Uncensored. I'm your host, Andre Stewart. And today, you know, I love bringing you guys guests from the financial space. And I always say every guest is a great guest because in my opinion, they are great guests. So we have another great guest here, Charles Sidman. He has a wonderful background. I love interviewing VCs and just people from all walks of life. And he has an interesting story on how he started and where he ended up. So Charles, how are you doing?
I'm good. Pleased to be here. So thank you.
I'm happy you came on. I got so many questions, and I'm pretty sure a lot of other people that are listening are going to want to know the answer to the questions that I have. So first of all, we know you have a background in the VC space, and you have a wonderful background even in biotech. But no one, you know, looking at your bio, I didn't know you had a military background. So if you can elaborate how you went from 7 years or 5 to 7 years in the reserves to being a VC, because that's a huge jump. And I'm pretty sure people are like, what, from military to VC? So give us a little bit about your background, how you went from to becoming the person you are.
Okay, well, my first professional activity was in the computer world, the digital world, pre-internet, pre-AI, but I was doing both a long time ago. We didn't call it that. Mm-hmm. And then I got into biomedical research. And, you know, I'm old, I got white hair. So that was the Vietnam era. And I was probably the last guy in the country to be drafted. I was drafted just a couple of weeks before the draft ended.
Oh, wow.
So I had some options. I looked around for options and I joined the National Guard, served there for 6 years while I was still going to school and, you know, learning the trade as a researcher. It was an interesting experience, not one that I probably would have sought out on my own, but, you know, I was used to dealing with academic types, and the National Guard service really broadened my experience of working with people from all walks of life. Got to do things and, you know, be in charge of stuff that I never would have otherwise.
Right.
So it was really part of my training and upbringing. So I don't regret it at all. And then I was a biomedical researcher and an academic for many, many decades. During a sabbatical, during that period, I was at a really wacky, wonderful Western research institute called the Santa Fe Institute. Mm. And I was talking to people I met there. And one guy told me he was a former entrepreneur, that he was now an angel investor. And I never heard the word. So went back, did some homework, learned about it, got involved in that world, started angel groups, did that for 10 or 15 years while I was an academic. And then finally I said, okay, I've written enough papers and grants. I've thrown enough ideas over the wall, hoping someone else would catch them and run with them. Okay, I'm going to go to the other side and be the guy who catches and runs with them. So I retired from academia and became a full-time investor. Still an angel, started a venture fund. I was one of the promoters of the Jobs Act and 10 years ago, 11 years ago, that opened up a lot of finance.
Yeah.
So they're all tools. I focus on early stage enterprises that have two characteristics. One, that they're technology based, because that's my background. I can understand the technology and talk to science guys. And two, I'm interested in things that have positive impact on the world, not just making money. I want to make a better place while I make a an unreasonable financial return. So that's what I do now.
Well, I do want to know this. My parents were military. My mom, both were in Army. My dad did 20. He was a drill sergeant. My mom made it to E9. She did 27 years. So I would like to ask, you know, you didn't want to charter that path, but you did go down that path. For me, even though I wasn't in the military, my parents were military. So I got a lot of discipline from that. Do you think, and it helped me out tremendously, there's a stark difference between someone who's been raised by military parents or someone that's gone in the military versus someone else. Do you think that helped you with your foundation as far as giving you like discipline and keeping you focused on your path to being an angel?
Yeah, certainly. It taught me a lot of discipline stuff. It also taught me that, you know, there's a right way, a wrong way, and sort of the prescribed way of doing a lot of things. Sometimes you try to invent a new way. I think the biggest thing for me is it taught me to work with a whole lot of different types and backgrounds of people.
Right.
You know, because I never would have been that broadly exposed to people if I hadn't been wearing that green suit.
And which makes a difference when it's coming to, and you can speak to this, when it comes to sales or even when it comes to being a VC, you have to go out and raise funds. I'm assuming you had to raise funds to start your fund, or did you just save money over the course of time and you just started the fund yourself and then go out and get capital from anywhere else?
More the latter, but you know, anything you're doing in life, whether I was writing a research grant to fund a research laboratory of, you know, several dozen people, or whether I'm trying to fund a company or trying to raise funds for my venture firm, you're always marketing. And one of the pieces of advice that I often tell entrepreneurs is, don't just tell me what's in your head, why you're doing, you know, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. Tell me how what you're doing is going to appeal to me.
Right.
It's going to scratch my itches.
Yeah.
Every interaction is a marketing and a sales interaction.
Exactly. And I think people don't get that. So you're always selling yourself, whether it be in an interview, whether it be customer service, whatever the case is, you're always selling yourself. So like you said, being able to have a diverse background of dealing with different people has allowed you to do certain things that a lot of people don't if they don't have that background or that exposure.
Right. And we can't just assume everyone is like ourselves because
exactly. Exactly.
They're very diverse.
So then your journey began early on. You know what I mean? I as a teenage entrepreneur, like, you know, elaborate on that. And starting early obviously gives you a different mindset because most people aren't really thinking about becoming an entrepreneur until they're like maybe mid-20s or they had a couple of jobs and they're like, I'm tired of this. What made you think in that early on about being an entrepreneur? And what were you an entrepreneur at?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we're all shaped by the luck and the opportunities we have.
Right.
So I happen to be a teenager just when computers were really entering the mainstream. And, you know, my school had a teletype machine in the corner and I had the opportunity to use it. My father, who is a research scientist, was my first boss. So I built computers for him, either putting them together myself or when the first mini computer and microcomputer chips came out, I used those. So I taught my father's entire research team how to use computers.
Wow.
And then my particular project was a project which now would be called AI, artificial intelligence, because there were some problems, mathematical problems that really a human could approximate and, you know, mess around with, but they couldn't solve or be optimal about it.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to make computers actually solve them fully. Mm-hmm. And so my computer product was unmatched by human capability. You know, it was used in my father's research. It was used in other places. And that really, those two things, you know, being on the forefront of building and advancing computers and doing what is now called AI and networking. I used what's called timeshare computing in those days because, you know, Al Gore had not invented the internet yet.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I was in Boston using computers in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went and did research in Europe, I still use computers on other continents. So, you know, all these things sort of made me think about, okay, there's the way we do it now, and then there's a better way that's coming down the road. And that's what an entrepreneur does.
Exactly. They foreshadow the future, right? Some people you can't do that. You can kind of, if you use data, which is what you're saying, and you just use history, you can forecast a lot of things, right?
And you can invent things. Now, they're not all going to work because I'm basically a biologist and I know that, you know, all good ideas don't succeed. It depends on the idea. It depends on the environment and the times and all that stuff. But success and advance only comes from new ideas.
Exactly. It's like motherboard.
Some and test them, and some of them are going to work. So that's then, in finance.
With that, what do you think? I mean, you kind of were one of the first to, you know, I guess, dabble in AI. What's your thoughts on AI? And, you know, there's always people out saying, oh, my God, AI is going to end the world. What's your thoughts on AI? Because you obviously been in it a long time and you're kind of one of the first. So what do you think?
Well, I'm not anti-computer. You know, I told you I've been doing it for all of a fairly long life at this point. I'm not anti-computer. They're wonderful tools. You know, you don't have to build a house only with a manual hammer. You use a nail gun and, you know, you don't use a handsaw. We have power saws. So tools are great. But I think computers, we have to remember that they are tools. We can't deify them as having greater wisdom than we do. Mm-hmm. A computer and AI are only running through programs that humans have developed.
Correct.
With a certain set of constraints and a certain set of limitations and targets. They're not smarter than us. In fact, they don't understand anything. They're just machines doing what they're told to do. So as long as we remember that, we can use them to our advantage. When we say that they're more intelligent than us and will guide us in our behavior, that they're, you know, super robots or, you know, deities, whatever, then I think we've given up our essential humanity and responsibility. So the fault is not on the machines then. The fault is on us for going down that, you know, wrongful path.
So in essence, we'd have to program this machine or the AI to annihilate humankind, in essence, right? If they're saying it's going to be smarter because it's only accessing the internet. That's how it's pulling its information in other data centers. It can't really just do what everybody's making it seem like it can do. Or
well, when we turn decision-making over to it, you know, if you want to have an auto land on an airplane. I used to be a flight instructor too. So I taught people how to land an airplane. A computer can be a very good landing machine. You know, it can land an airplane through total fog. And that works because it sees things and adjusts really fast. That's an appropriate use of computers. If you tell a computer to say, okay, how we're going to judge the worth of a human life or who gets priority medical treatment, that I think is giving up too much. You know, in a car, a self-driving car, you know, the classical thing is, who do you wipe out? The mom pushing a baby carriage or a whole crowd of people? How do you give that decision over to a machine?
Yeah, true, 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 true. You're right.
And there's no data that deals with that.
Correct.
And yet the car is going to do something with whatever limited and insufficient programming it's got. That's wrong.
Yeah. I get it now. From your standpoint, I do. Like, if you just tell the AI or their machine to do something and be like, you know what, you think you do what's best, kill a baby and a mom, or like you said, kill a crowd of people. That's just a hard decision. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. I give you another example, you know, healthcare. What do we want to aim for? The longest life for the patient in front of us, the longest life for the most people, the highest quality life, the cheapest medical system? Which of these parameters are we going to make the machine aim for?
Correct.
When you make a decision about medical care for yourself and your family, you're taking all these things into account.
Yeah.
A machine can't take everything into account together.
Correct.
And so you got to make your own decision in that situation. Don't let a machine do it for you.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I told you I worked at Silicon Valley Bank, and I would see, I've seen a football field or soccer field with 15 robots playing soccer. You know what I mean? So there's things out there that I don't know that other people are aware of, that if you program this thing a certain way, even it being a machine, now you've given it the ability to think, like you said. And it's like, do I save, you know, 5,000 people or do I kill 10,000? Like, it's going to be a hard decision for this thing to, you know.
Soccer is unidimensional. You got to put a little ball through a net. And that's easy. But what about pushing a human child or player to the point of, you know, self-harm?
Yeah.
An injury.
Yeah.
What about their psychology?
Yeah. So
computer doesn't think about this stuff.
As you can see where it could go south real fast. When, and we still have human error. Like we still have people that think a certain type of way. And I mean, most of the time people that are working on these computers, they might not be, you know, I would say customer facing or dealing with people all the time, right? Most of the time they're just in the back. Their connection to humanity is slightly different. If you're in a room for, you know, 6 months out of the year and you see a person three times, you know, out of that time frame, you might make a different decision than someone that sees and interacts with someone on or people on a regular, consistent basis. You know what I mean? So most computer science or people that do that just aren't, this is just my opinion, they're not really in touch with humanity, like on a scale of like a teacher who's dealing with like 20 kids. You know what I mean?
Well, kids in different, you know, from different backgrounds.
Exactly.
This class of 20 kids are going to be different from that class of 20 kids.
Correct.
So that's the problem. And you can't let 22-year-olds who've never done anything except learned how to deal with numbers and machines
and code
set the course of human behavior.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. I can see how this can go south really fast. That's not funny, but yeah, just putting it all together. And I've never really thought about it. I've never really thought about, because like I told you, I have a mobile app. So I know I work with coders. I've coded before. So it's like, yeah, the coding mentality versus the fireman's mentality is just two different mentalities, right? And so we have the coder, not the fireman, who's doing the code. So that in itself, yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So then I want to go back to what you said about the Jobs Act. You said you were a proponent for the Jobs Act, which makes sense. I think that was back in, did Obama? I think Obama passed the Jobs Act, right? Can you hear me?
Can we take a 2-minute break? I'm going to go change to a different network. Would that work?
Oh, yeah, it would for sure. One sec. I'm going to pause it. So switching gears, you mentioned the Jobs Act early in the conversation. I want to touch on that because I'm in the process of crowdfunding to raise funds for my mobile app, where we're using a platform called WeFunder. You probably heard of Start Engine. So we're using those. So in your opinion, and I've talked about, I did a whole entire podcast dedicated to people using crowdfunding as a way to source revenue, source income for, you know, doing their deals. Because a lot of times, you know, we talked about it earlier, VCs only take, you know, generally 10 to 12 deals a year. And so you have other businesses that VCs don't want to fund, but you can still go on a crowdfunding platform and get your business funded. So what are your thoughts on that? Because you do have experience in, you know, crowdfunding in the angel space. What do you think about crowdfunding as an option?
It's a perfectly good tool. You know, in your toolbox, you've got hammers and screwdrivers and saws, and it's a perfectly good tool. Now, I've written a lot and I've given a lot of, you know, lectures, presentations. It's not the same as angel investing. It's not the same as VCs. It's for different, maybe a different or, you know, distinct set of entrepreneurs and a distinct set of investors. I get into crowdfunding for two reasons. One is it opens up more funding sources for more investors. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's some kind of businesses that, you know, are not high growth or they're very local or they just won't attract the attention of VCs and angels. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole lot of, you know, wonderful community things that you can't get investment because they're not competitive in terms of return. So one of my enthusiasms for crowdfunding is to increase the funding sources and mechanisms for entrepreneurs. The second one was for the investors themselves. You know, VCs and angels are limited by this whole notion of an accredited investor, which came about in the 1930s in the Great Depression. So many people lost so much money through investing in Wall Street that the government couldn't deal with it. And so they said, basically, okay, 90 or 95% of the population isn't wealthy enough to be able to afford to lose money. Mm-hmm. So then they can't. And they're still allowed to buy lottery tickets and go mm-hmm. to the racetrack and donate in church and, you know, get rid of their money, but yeah. They're not allowed to do it through investing.
That's funny.
So I don't think it really solved the problem. It was just kind of a political knee-jerk reaction to that situation. And so 90 or 95% of our population isn't allowed to obtain the financial returns of well done early stage investing. And so the crowdfunding is a partial answer to that as well. So those are the two reasons I got in. I was deeply involved with the leadership of several organizations and lobbied in Washington, D.C. and talked to the SEC. And, you know, I pulled on my oar to get this ship moving. It's not perfect yet, and other countries do it slightly differently, but it's a good tool. It's a good vehicle. And, you know, I'm an accredited investor, and I'm a, you know, established and recognized angel in VC. So I have a lot of deal flow that I am able to participate in, but even I have participated in a couple of crowdfunded investment opportunities that I saw through crowdfunding, and that then, given my, you know, my experience, I then investigate in a deeper way than most crowdfunding investors are able to. But still, I learned about them through crowdfunding channels and platforms. So I've got, you know, anybody can lose money on investing. And you have to remember that in the earlier you go, the more likely is any particular deal is going to fail.
Right.
But the ones that succeed will earn you much more than a late stage deal will. Everybody can invest on Wall Street and maybe they double and triple their money, but you don't often 10 times or 50 times or 100 times your money on Wall Street.
Right. And then elaborate on what you said, you know, about the accredited investor thing. That's unfortunate. You know what I mean? Someone might have $150,000 or $200,000 in the bank, but just because they don't have $1 million in total assets or something like that, or they don't make a certain amount, they can't get into options where people that make a ton of money. So these people that maybe have $200,000, they can't get that exponential gain as someone would, like you just mentioned. That's the beauty of being being able to do crowdfunding, because now those companies like mine, I'm going to raise on a crowdfunding platform for different reasons. You can give someone shares for 10, 15 cents like a VC would get, or not, maybe not 10 or 15 cents, but you understand what I'm saying, like very low cost. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, I do think that everybody has to realize and remember one of the most basic truths is if you're going to get into this game, as an investor, you have to diversify. And that's the difference between an investor and an entrepreneur. The entrepreneur has to focus 110% on their venture.
Correct.
You can't do anything else. The investor has to make sure that they're exposed to, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 early stage enterprises.
Correct.
In order to increase the chances that they're going to have a couple of winners and make the whole thing worthwhile. So, if you're going to invest in 20 or 30 or 40 enterprises, you've got to be able to discipline yourself. Let's say you had that person you're mentioning who has $200,000 in the bank. They better not put it all into one venture.
Correct.
They better put $5,000 or $10,000 each into 20 or 30 or 40 ventures. But that again is another limitation, because a crowdfunding platform will accept that $5,000 or $10,000. Most angel and venture deals, they don't want to talk to the $5,000 and $10,000 investor.
Correct.
So, and that's also now a reason why there are funds that work in the accredited space like mine, to allow $5,000 and $10,000 exposures and participation in a lot of deals that on their own they wouldn't be able to do. So they're all worthwhile. They're all just different, you know, tools.
So then that's good then. I didn't know your fund did that. Elaborate more on how your fund does that and you're allowed to just take in $5,000 or $10,000 deals.
Well, I don't take them in, but I'm organized under the standard angel and VC rules. So in fact, I can only deal with accredited investors. They've got to have that net worth or that income. But I take in commitments of as little as $25,000. At $25,000, whether it's $25,000 or $25 million, I'm going to divvy that up into a diversified portfolio. So whether a person invests $25,000 or $250,000 or $2.5 million or whatever with us, we're going to give them over 100 starter investments, which means they're going to be making investments of $50 and $100 and $200 effectively, because we divvy it up among all our people. but they'll have enough that we can be pretty sure that some of theirs and some of mine, because I'm in the same deals, are going to pay off. And then we also reserve capital so that successive later rounds can be invested in, because in these early stage growth companies, one thing you don't hear on the crowdfunding platforms, but you learn with experience, is that you can put some money in early on, but if you're not prepared and able to participate in the second and the third and the fourth round, you're going to get squeezed out. And it's not just percentage-wise. The deal terms are such, and this is just the real world, the way the game is played, the latest investors get the best deal. Mm. And they're going to get their payoff before the early investors get anything.
Mm.
And, you know, that's unfair and unfortunate, but that's the way life works. And so a person who is able to put $5,000 or $10,000 even into 20 deals, if they don't have another $200,000 and $400,000 and $600,000 reserved for the later stages, they're still not going to succeed.
Ever wished you had the opportunity to buy a stock like Facebook, Amazon, or Netflix before it went public, or was able to get shares in companies like VC firms and angel investors? Well, here's your chance. Go to investfar.com/invest and reserve a position. For the next 1 to 3 months, InvestFAR is allowed a limited number of low-cost shares be available for friends, family, and its community per SEC regulations before it goes public. Imagine being able to 1,000x or 10,000x your investment, like the top 5%. With exclusive opportunities such as this, positions are limited and the window of time is short. Don't miss your chance. That's INV, as in Victor, estfar.com/invest.
So let me elaborate on this a little bit more, so some people may not be understanding. Basically, his fund takes in accredited investors. You still have to be an accredited investor to go into his fund. But he'll take a check for $25,000 and he'll diversify that $25,000 over multiple companies, 15 to 20 companies. And so he could put 2,000 in one company, 5,000 in one company, 10,000 in one company, just to, it's just, if you can elaborate on what I'm saying as far as that goes. So he'll take the 25,000 and spread it out over the companies that he sees fit. Correct.
So, one, I diversify it. I guarantee that anybody, whether they give me 25,000 or 25 million, is going to get proportionate access to the same set of startup companies.
Mm-hmm.
But even before that, or in addition to that, I only use about a quarter of our assets for the first checks to all these companies. And I save three quarters for much more selective second and third round investments in the companies that are actually making it. Because if I invest in 100 startup companies, I've done my homework. I'm enthusiastic about all 100 of them. I don't know which ones are really going to be making it and deserve, not need, but deserve a second check or a third check. And so we keep three quarters of our funds reserved for the later rounds, which it's very hard to fight the enthusiasm when you're doing it on your own.
So let me elaborate on that really fast. What he's saying as well is, so if he takes the 25,000 and invested in those early stage companies, say they do make it to the second or third round, you need to have cash available because the people in that first round are more than likely going to be diluted and their shares are going to get decreased, or is that not correct?
Well, what you said is true, but dilution is not the worst of it.
Mm.
Dilution just means you own a smaller percentage of the company, which is not bad if the value of your holding goes up. You know, let's say you're diluted by 50%.
Mm.
That's okay if the value of your holding now goes up by fourfold.
Correct.
You're making money. So dilution is not the enemy. The enemy is the terms in what's called a waterfall that the second round investors are going to get their return before the first round investors get anything.
So please,
the third round investors will get theirs before the second rounders get anything.
Elaborate more on that, because I know people are wondering, how in the world I was in first, why do I get my money last? So why does the person that came in the end get their money before me? So explain that.
Well, the entrepreneur is stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, when they need money, and they're dealing with sometimes sharks.
Yeah, it's a lot of times.
And even if they're not sharks, those investors have their first obligation is to their investors.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you the case that really taught me this in the biggest, most obvious way. I invested in a company that was in the nanotechnology carbon fiber world. And I invested in an early round. And then I invested in the A round. And then in the B round. I think I skipped the C round because it wasn't as good a deal or I didn't feel the urge. I did the D round and I did the E round. When the company was finally sold, the E round got 95% of the proceeds. The D round got the other 5%. The C round, which a lot of my friends were in, got nothing. The B round and the A round, which I was also in, got nothing. So I made some money on that deal, but only because I was there all throughout and I participated in the last round that set the terms and the landscape for the eventual exit.
That that's what it is.
I'm sorry, but that's the way the world works.
So now we got to dive.
You have the experience.
We got to dive into that. So basically what he's saying is all of the people that invested from, let's say, friends and family, and they might have got a convertible note or something like that, all the way to, you know, Series D investor came in and set new terms. And those new terms basically, I guess, wiped out the everyone in the, before the Series D.
Well, they don't wipe them out. They just, it's called a waterfall. They get theirs first.
Got it. Wow.
And the B did it to the A's, the C did it to the B's, the D's did it to the C's.
So that's on almost every single deal or that's just select based on a contract?
No, it's pretty routine. And well, it's all contractual. Mm-hmm. And it's what you got to give the latest, most important investor in order to get the check when you need it.
That's true.
It's all competitive. They can put their money elsewhere. You can evaluate different funders as an entrepreneur, but it's always a negotiation and it's a market. And, you know, who says the farmer who farms oranges always gets what he deserves?
That's true. So then in a case like this, if someone is going on a WeFunder or a Start Engine, what's your advice to them so they don't lose? I know you said keep money available, but what, you know, if they're getting in early, what's the wish or what's the hope that, what would be the ideal situation? Should they hope that this company exits at Series A or what?
Well, it's tough when you only have the resources to get in at the first round and it's the kind of company that's likely going to need additional rounds. Mm-hmm. That's very risky because you know someone is going to come in later and rejigger the terms, and the later rounds are typically not done through crowdfunding.
Correct.
So one kind of crowdfunding which is safer is when it's broken up, not in a fund, but deal by deal, let's say real estate, so that when you crowdfund a real estate property, you're going to get a piece of this building.
Right.
And you're not going to have to keep growing the building because the building's built. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's unlikely to need further rounds of investment. So in a sense, it's more likely to be a safer investment. Another thing is if companies, there's a kind of crowdfunding called Reg A Plus.
Yeah, Reg A Plus.
Which is almost a public offering.
Correct.
And that's usually done or very often done for common shares. And once there are common shares to a lot of people for a lot of money, it's very unusual to go back to preferred shares. It's these preferred contractual private shares that often have these waterfalls.
Got it.
So maybe that has a greater amount of safety to it. But when you're in the so-called Reg D, private contractual investment world, it's really hard to do as an amateur. Mm-hmm. You've got all kinds of cards stacked against you. And that's why if you want to play in that world, and most of my deals are in that Reg D private arena. You just have to have the resources and the experience to do it, you know, with a high degree of likelihood of success. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that 95% of angels, if they want to play in this world, they're better off by being limited partners in funds like mine. There are many others that trying to do it themselves because, you know, it's long term. It's intensive at times. It takes resources, takes experience. And the analogy I sometimes make is, you know, as a flight instructor, I used to teach people how to fly an airplane. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. They could fly a small airplane for a limited distance. If they want to reliably and safely go from California to Maine, they're probably better off buying a ticket on Delta or American,
right,
which are professionals, rather than trying to take their own little, you know, plane across the country and have weather delays and run out of gas and all that stuff. You know, you can get into a game, you can learn it, you can play it, but to be a professional and have the greatest success, leave it to the professionals. You know, we don't typically do our own or our children's dental work. We let a professional do it.
One thing I will say, you know, just to help the people that are listening, you know, if you don't have the hundreds or $200,000, if you do go on a platform like WeFunder or StartEngine, you can see what kind of shares are being offered. So based on what he just said, if it says preferred shares, they're probably going to fall under their waterfall and you might not want to take those. But if it says common shares, which you can see, or if it says safe note or something like that, then that might give you some kind of, but nonetheless, out of all of this, you still have to do the due diligence. You know what I mean? So if you're trying to still just be able to get into some kind of form of investing in early stage companies, ideally, if you do have enough money and you are accredited, then you go with someone like Charles and his fund. Or if you go on a Refunder or a StartEngine, you want to look for the right type of shares and you want to read the contract or read what type of shares are going to be offered once that round closes.
Well, it's easy to get in. It's harder to get out. And still remember to diversify. Mm-hmm. Whatever pocketbook you have, split it into 20 or 40 or whatever pieces. Do not overcommit.
Exactly.
You're going to regret that. An investor colleague of mine once said that, you know, while you're putting money in, you're a philanthropist. It's only when you get your money out that you're an investor.
I like that. As an investor, you literally are just giving, right? In hopes that when you sell, there's something there. So that makes sense. Speaking of that, giving, I know you have you like to do impact investing. So give us a little bit about that. People hear impact investing all the time. I don't know if they necessarily know what it means. So if you can elaborate on impact investing and what it is and what do you do in that space as far as that goes?
Right. Okay. Well, that's a really good question. Most people, when they hear impact investing, they think it means making investments for less than market rate returns. They're giving up the returns to do something good for the world.
Mm-hmm.
I call that charity or philanthropy. It's a wonderful thing, but it's not the kind of investing I do. So I'm still hoping for the, you know, aggressive market rate returns, and the early stage returns are 25 to 30%. If you take all the data, all of it, put it together, you know, you can't get that from a bank.
Nope.
Probably can't get that from VC, but you can get it from early stage investing if you do it responsibly and professionally. So I'm still after that financial return, but I also want to feel good about my activity and the ventures that I support. I want to feel proud that I supported these ventures and not other ventures, because if I didn't have that motivation, I'd just go into narcotics and you'd make a lot of money by ruining people's lives. So I'm not going to do that. So for me, that means a focus on certain areas that are meaningful to me and my set of values as an individual. And my values are not necessarily yours, and that I respect that. But for me, I focus on two major areas. One is health. And so that's medicines and diagnostics and devices and therapeutics and nutrition and things like that, because I believe that making people healthier is something we all want and need, and it serves everybody.
Yeah.
The second thing is I focus on sustainability, because, you know, we're barreling down the road of wrecking our environment and our planet. And so if we can make energy sustainable and renewable, and we can reduce waste, and we can make transportation more effective, you know, these are all parts of sustainability, electrification of things, environmentalism. There are lots of ventures that are designed to have these effects. And if I can make a ton of money while supporting them and participating in them, that, you know, floats all my boats. So those are my two focus areas. There are some people who are impact investors and they focus on education. That's fine. I've been a teacher, but I think it's a very hard nut to crack, because, you know, education doesn't operate separate from society, and you know, students and families have a lot of, you know, burdens to bear. Some people do impact investing for entertainment, or you know, online sports. I've got nothing against movies, and I enjoy going to movies, but I don't think movies are the most essential thing in life, so I don't do impact investing for entertainment. Mm. Other people do, and that's fine. You know, you got to define what your chosen impacts are, what meets your values and enthusiasms to be an impact investor. And I do want to say that impact investors, that doesn't say enough. To be an impact investor, we assume that you want to have positive impact, but there are some ventures that are negatively impactful.
Yeah.
And they're impact investors too, but they're, you know, destroying things rather than, you know, building and improving things.
Yeah.
So I always say you can't claim to be an impact investor. You have to be an investor who's committed to positive impact. And you gotta define it.
I agree with that. So then how does someone get deals in front of you? I know you say you obviously you get deals all the time. You know, for the listeners, how does someone get a deal in front of you, and what type of deals do you like outside of the impact part? And I guess what's your check amount for the early, you know, your minimum check amount that will go out?
Right. All right. So getting deals. I spend the majority of my time as a hunter-gatherer, you know, like a caveman was, looking for a bush full of tasty berries or a little animal to capture and eat.
Yeah.
I go all around the world and I spend most of my time reading pitch decks and business summaries and attending events all the time, all over the world, where people have been selected and get the opportunity to pitch their venture.
Mm-hmm.
And from those, I might see 1,000 a year. And that's the result of, you know, 10,000 maybe being developed, and somebody has pared that down to 1,000. I will pare that down very rapidly based on my interests and enthusiasms and experience to 100. I'll do some work on the 100, and then maybe I'll invest in 10 of them.
Mm.
So it's incredibly selective. Sounds hopeless for an entrepreneur, but my answer to that is there's a lot of people just like me in the enthusiasms and interests. So even if I'm going to invest in 1% of what I see, somebody else will invest in a different 1% of what they see.
Correct.
So any entrepreneur can find an audience. And that's kind of a tenet of faith. If it excites you, it'll excite somebody else. So don't give up, even though any individual investor is very selective. And so once I hone in on the 1% that look good to me, I go through my evaluation process. And I was a scientist for most of my life, and scientists never prove anything. They just disprove ideas.
Yeah.
So for me, I put it through my screening process, and I'm looking for reasons not to invest. If I can't come up with one, then I'm stuck. Ooh, maybe I should invest in this one. And then it's a prioritization, you know, balancing the portfolio and, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. So in the end, I will usually write a first check in the $25,000 to $50,000 range.
Mm.
But I want to get in on the best 1% of deals that I can find with all of my work all over the planet. I know that they're not all going to reach the promised land and pay off. So I'm reserving 3/4 of my funds. If I invest in 100 first-time investments at 25K each, I want to then put a second check of maybe 10 times as much, 250,000, into 10 of them.
Mm.
And then into one or two of those, I want to be able to put a $500 or $750 or $1 million investment into a couple that are really making it. So that's my professional experienced approach. Maybe 25K doesn't sound like much, but I have to diversify. I have to get involved in a whole lot of ventures to see them and keep learning about them from the inside. And that means that I can't fund a venture by myself. I don't want to. I always want to have and always will have co-investors who are lending their wisdom and experience to supplement mine.
Mm-hmm.
So the investors all talk to each other, and then together they pool their 25 and 50Ks to the, you know, $250,000 or $500,000 or $1 million that an early stage enterprise is often seeking. And then the early stage enterprise not only has a bunch of money, they have a bunch of colleagues, teammates, right. Yep. Which is worth at least as much as the money.
Mm-hmm. The wisdom.
Yeah. And even participation, you know, you need a board, you need ambassadors, you need contacts. All right. of these things are really great to have. And that's what your early investors provide in addition to the money.
So what space are you in?
Well, health and sustainability are my big areas.
Okay. So then if anybody listening, if you have health and sustainability as a business and you want to have it looked at, how does someone get that in front of you? Do you have an email or is it?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm on LinkedIn and you can find me just with a simple Google search for ECS Capital Partners. I have to say that most of my deals do not come to me personally, individually. Most of them I see at events where, you know, every city in this country has an angel group in it. I think those and an accelerator and an incubator, working with those people are going to help the entrepreneur develop their pitch, develop their program to the point when it becomes feasible and attractive. Then the entrepreneur should present at the local angel group for first, you know, outside investor experience and exposure. They'll get questions. They'll be set back on their heels. They'll answer those questions. They'll get better and better with every interaction. And then those deals that look the most promising are going to be shared with other investor groups, venture capitalists, angels, et cetera. And eventually the best deals will get the most money.
That's true.
And, you know, the ones that I invest in are every group that I've been in, I haven't followed blindly, but maybe I invest in one out of 10 that they do because I've got my own criteria. But everybody's responsible for their own, you know, course and outcomes.
And so your numbers align. And like I said, I worked in Silicon Valley Bank. And before then, I know people would try to get debt or they would try to do whatever. But like he's saying, if you invest in 10 deals, that's along the average. So I have a ton of friends that were founders and they was like, I had to go see 51 VCs or 75 VCs or 80, you know, 100 VCs before my business got funded. So you got to go through so many because of the numbers that he just said, even with him looking through 100 or even him, you're doing 1%, right? Those are some hard odds for anybody, right? So you go from 10,000 down to 1,000, down to 100, down to 10. It's almost impossible to get funded. You know what I mean? So.
Well, but there are a lot of, every year, thousands and thousands and thousands of businesses get funding.
Correct.
You know, so they find investors. And if it excites one person, it's going to excite other people.
Correct.
You know, not maybe the first person you talk to, maybe it'll be the 51st person, but it's your job to find that 51st person.
So keep that in mind, guys. For me, I think I had a meeting with 5 VCs. They all were interested. And so I'm globalizing real estate investing. So I was really early on when I went out there, right? I didn't really have a bunch of markets. And so I had an MVP. So now we're beyond that. We're well beyond that. And I haven't tried to raise funds since. You know what I mean? Because now we're making revenue. But again, so I only saw 5. I would have had to, if we go based on averages, I need to go see at least 50 to 60 more people if I want to get my venture funded. You know what I mean? And that's just kind of how it is.
Right. And you were dealing with venture capital firms. They're further up the line. Most VCs are not ready to fund an MVP. They want actual customers and growth.
They want you at 100,000 or 200,000 customers or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So the angels are going to be more receptive to the earlier venture.
Correct.
And the crowdfunders probably still more receptive.
Exactly. That was leading me to my next point. So then I was like, you know what? I'm kind of like you. I want to be able to, this is what my entire, you know, me as a person is about. I got an investing podcast. I've written 3 books, right? So I'm trying to help people out. So my next thought was I can go out here and see 100 people, but I kind of wanted to be able to do something like a crowdfunding to allow people to get shares, just regular everyday people to be able to get their hand in some way. You know what I mean? That was my thought process behind trying to do something like that. Right. So,
well, everything has pluses and minuses. I mean, the plus is it's easier for more people to get a share.
Exactly.
The downside is, if I liked your venture that I found on a crowdfunding platform, I'm still going to get up close and personal with you. We're going to have coffee. We're going to have Zoom conversations. Mm-hmm. I'm going to challenge you. We're going to talk about your business plan and your financials and all that stuff. I'm going to do a whole lot more work just based on my level of experience and professionalism than your typical crowdfunding investor will.
Right.
And, you know, if you don't have time for that, well, bless you, but you won't get me as an investor.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like I said, to piggyback off that, I think what I'm saying is, people that are listening, if you don't have the time, like he's saying, then your best bet is to try to go on a crowdfunding platform and create the best looking landing page that you can. And hopefully you get someone that might give you, you know, $50,000 to get other people on the crowdfunding platform interested to want to invest in your venture. You know what I mean? So if not, you got to go this route, right? And so that could be a shortcut, but for how long? And there's no guarantee that people on the crowdfunding platform are going to invest in your product as well.
Right. Well, even on crowdfunding, to have some anchor investors who can be advocates
Correct.
And referral sources is really important.
You need a lead investor, by the way.
Yeah.
Yep. So you're not just going to go on there and be like, hey, you need lead investors to get through. And even for you to be able to pull those funds in the end, you have to have a lead investor, which I believe has to be accredited, by the way.
Yeah, well, different ones operate differently. But it's a set of tools that in the right circumstances, it's great. In the wrong circumstances, you know, power saws are great, but you can occasionally cut your arm off or your leg off.
I agree with that. Charles, any kind of advice, any kind of last advice to give people trying to, actually two questions. Anyway, I just did an interview, like I told you, with someone who started a private equity firm. I'm in the process of doing that myself. I'm starting a private fund. So any advice that you can give on for people trying to, you know, become an angel investor and even start their own fund?
Well, okay. To become an angel investor, you got to be accredited. Well, to standard angel investor, if you're not going to do only crowdfunding platforms, I consider crowdfunding investors angel investors because
Correct.
Angel investors write checks with their own money. Venture capitalists write checks with other people's money. That's the Correct. Only difference. Now.
Yeah.
But if you want to be in the private called Reg D world, you got to be accredited. And the best way to learn this, you know, there's lots of great books and videos and stuff. The best way to learn it is to join an angel group in your town and sit in and talk to learn from your colleagues. 10 years from now, you'll know what you're doing, but it takes a long time.
It does.
The other option is to, while you're learning, put your money in with a venture fund like mine, who will give you the exposure and the professionalism and hopefully not make all the mistakes again that we've all made before.
Yeah. What's the name of your fund, by the way, so people know?
ECS Capital Partners.
Mm-hmm. When the website?
ECS-partners.com.
There you go. Take a look at that. And then you mentioned books. Any books that you can recommend anyone?
Oh, there's a ton of good books about angel investing. I mean, just Google it. And investors from New York to California have written great books. You know, it's an art, almost a science. But so many people have done it, you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
All the principles are there.
Yep.
If you just listen, sometimes, 2 + 2 = 4. We all know that. Go into a second grade classroom. Some of the kids are going to write 5. That's not necessary, but it's going to keep happening.
I agree. That's funny. Well, I mean, like you said, guys, look up some of the books, but do what he said. I think the in-person is better. So if you guys, go online, Google angel investor groups, and I'm pretty sure most of the time people that have wealth want to bring other people along, right? You know what I mean? If you add value to them, they'll add value to you. That's just kind of how it goes. So do what he said, join a group and take your investing to the next level. You know what I mean? Even if you have $100,000, that's still more than a lot of people. And if you want to allocate some of that, like he says, even if you go on a crowdfunding platform, maybe take $25,000 and diversify that $25,000 amongst maybe 15 companies or 25 companies. Exactly. 25. Put up $1,000, especially on a crowdfunding platform, because that $1,000 is going to go a long way with those companies on a crowdfunding platform.
Yeah. So it's experience. one truth is that we make all these investments, we give it our best shot, we do our homework. Half of them or three quarters of them are still going to fizzle, and we don't know which half or three quarters ahead of time. Even if you make money or don't lose money on half or two thirds, the fact remains that you're going to make most of your money on the one or two super performers.
Right.
And that's whether you're a VC or an angel or a crowdfunder. So give yourself enough shots, enough chances for that super performer, which you're not going to be able to identify until it happens.
I agree. Thank you for coming on, Charles. I appreciate that information. And give us your LinkedIn, and then...
Well, just go on LinkedIn and Google me, either Charles Sidman or ECS Capital Partners, and I'll pop right up.
All right. Thank you again, Charles.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.